Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an agreement just reached in Geneva between the foreign ministers of the US, Russia, the EU and Ukraine that may at least temporarily end the crisis in Ukraine and bring Russia and Ukraine back from the brink of a shooting war. John Quigley, who has dealt with conflicts between Russia and Ukraine on behalf of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, the same organization who are now supposed to oversee and monitor this agreement, joins us to examine the agreement. He is a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and was a research scholar at Moscow State University. And we will look into who will disarm those occupying the buildings and whether Putin, who broke the 1994 Budapest Agreement when he took over Crimea, will live up to this agreement. Then we'll assess the backlash and unintended consequences of Putin's intimidation of Ukraine with Dr. Howard Hall, the Oak Ridge National Laboratory Governor's Chair in Nuclear Security, and Natalie Menieva, Research Assistant in the Institute for Nuclear Security at the University of Tennessee. They have an article at CNN, "Is Ukraine About to Go Nuclear Again?" And we will discuss whether, since two of Ukraine's political parties, Strike and Fatherland, have introduced a bill in Parliament to revoke the country's 1994 signature to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Ukraine will follow Putin's advice in his New York Times message to the American people that, if you cannot count on international law, then you must find other ways to ensure your security. If you have the bomb, nobody will touch you. Then finally, we will speak with Dan Fagan, who just won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. We will discuss this superb scientific detective story and great example of investigative journalism about corporate greed, government neglect, and courageous citizens who refused to keep silent until the truth was exposed about who and what was causing cancer clusters in a New Jersey seaside town. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking with Dan Fagan, who just won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction for his new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And joining us now is John Quigley, who is a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses of War, American Interventionism Since World War II. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Quigley.
Thank you very much.
And the agreement that has apparently been reached in Geneva between the foreign ministers of the U.S., the European Union, Russia, and Ukraine have agreed to de-escalate the crisis in Ukraine. And although we don't have a lot of specifics at this point, but they're talking about amnesty for all anti-government protesters, and these steps that they've agreed to will be overseen by monitors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the group that you've worked with, John. Are you confident that this has successfully de-escalated this crisis? Because yesterday it looked like it was such a tinderbox that at any moment Russia and Ukraine could go to war.
Yes, I think it has, at least for now, de-escalated the conflict and eliminated the possibility of any flare-up of a significant kind in the short term. Whether it will hold in the long term is another question. But at least for now, it's a very hopeful sign in that it does seem to reflect the view of all the major parties that steps can be taken that will mean that there's not going to be a flare-up.
But at this point, Russia is the winner in as much as it has gotten away with annexing Crimea. It's made a mockery of the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, and it has, you know, I don't know what you can say about scared the dickens out of the government in Kiev that's basically barely formed and is about to get some legitimacy in assuming the May 25th elections take place. So, and just before this agreement was reached, Putin on national television in a call-in show in Russia said it is his right and it's Russia's right to move into Ukraine. So how much of those threats are off the table now?
Well, this would seem to mean that, at least in the short term, Mr. Putin is not planning to act on that statement that he made on that program. But I think you're right that this statement does implicitly acknowledge Russia's position in Crimea. It's a statement, actually, that doesn't say anything about what Russia will or will not do. It doesn't say anything about what the United States will or will not do, or what the European Union will or will not do. It's entirely about the domestic situation in Ukraine. But I think it carries a strong implication that the West is not going to ratchet up sanctions, and that Russia is not going to move troops into Ukraine. But it does, I think, by not mentioning Crimea, also indicate that that the West is at least accepting, if it doesn't like it, perhaps, but at least accepting Russia's position in Crimea.
And the other aspect, of course, of Putin's call-in, apart from the fact that Edward Snowden called into the show, which doesn't seem like an accident, and asked an extraordinarily softball question about whether Russia has surveillance over its citizens like the Americans do. But Putin did admit that the little green men, as the Ukrainians call it, that invaded Ukraine were in fact Russians, which is something he hadn't admitted to before. So how do you navigate around the kind of the cynical use of the truth on the part of Vladimir Putin?
Well, I mean, you can't anticipate complete honesty in all of these things. The agreement does have a provision. Well, I don't know if I should call it an agreement. The joint statement coming out of Geneva today says that all illegal armed groups must be disarmed. I think that is a reference, although it doesn't say it, you know, to the people you're talking about in Ukraine. And while it doesn't say who is supposed to disarm them, I think it's suggested that it would be Russia. Whether that will happen, I don't know.
But it also says that these actions will be monitored by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. So how long is that going to take? I mean, in other words, you're suggesting that Putin, since the so-called political tourists, and apparently there are a lot of Russian intelligence agents already in eastern Ukraine, that they're going to step down before the OSCE comes in?
Well, there's nothing about timing in this joint statement. So, but it says that the OSCE is to assist Ukrainian authorities and the local communities in the implementation of the de-escalation measures, and I'm not sure exactly what local communities means, whether that can be a reference to, I wouldn't think it would be a reference to the groups that are sponsored by Russia. But there are, in Ukraine, as we've seen over the last couple of days, a lot of local people who are very upset about the fact that the Ukrainian army has moved into that territory, and that the government in Kiev has characterized it as an anti-terrorist operation. And so that's what I think the OSCE is going to be monitoring to make sure that there are no confrontations between the Ukrainian army and local communities.
Well, not only that, and that doesn't appear to have been particularly effective on the part of the government in Kiev, that incursion. But, you know, the argument is, of course, that they didn't have any choice. If they were to roll over like they did in Crimea, they would have simply have given up eastern Ukraine. But the fact that there was local resistance indicates to me that this government in Kiev has got a lot of work to do to win over its own citizens in the east.
I think that's very clear. And that's something that perhaps the OSCE can facilitate. The OSCE has been involved in Ukraine for quite some time, and a lot of its people are quite familiar with the situation. So the Ukrainian government does have a real problem about winning the, if not the affection, at least the acquiescence of the population in eastern Ukraine. the fact that the parliament immediately after it threw out Mr. Yanukovych, passed a law on languages that was unfavorable to the use of Russian as an official language. That was a major mistake, I think, which the government realized within a couple of days and went
right,
back
and,
on
and,
it.
And Lavrov just brought it up again in Geneva.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, what Kerry brought up, I think, is pretty grim, and I was reading about this yesterday, that these masked pro-Russian gunmen were confronting Jewish worshippers coming out of synagogues on Passover in eastern Ukraine, telling them that they had to get an ID number and declare themselves citizens and pay a fee. And Kerry brought up this grotesque idea of what was happening there, of the Jews in the east of Ukraine have to register themselves as being Jewish, which is a flashback to the Nazis. And that's the very rhetoric that Putin and company have been accusing the Ukrainian government in Kiev of, when yet it's happening on there by being done by Russian surrogates.
Well, I'm not sure about the facts of that, so I can't comment on it. I'm not sure that I except what Mr. Kerry is saying about who is doing that. I mean, he may be correct, but it sounds so out of character for what's going on there that I find it a bit hard to think that it actually happened that way.
Well, the pamphlets themselves that were handed out to the Jewish worshippers leaving synagogues on Passover have been widely displayed on the internet, so the content is not up for question. I guess the extent of the anti-Semitism is where the question is, right?
Well, and who's behind it?
But the Russian propaganda that this whole government in Kiev are a bunch of fascists and anti-Semites, that's clearly overblown.
It is overblown, but there is some truth in it, unfortunately, and that's part of what needs to be worked out in this process that this joint statement is calling for. It calls for a constitutional process, transparent and accountable, for a broad national dialogue with outreach to all of Ukraine's regions and political constituencies. And that's not going to be easy to do. By any means, but I think the people in the East have to be convinced that those what are being called neo-fascist tendencies are at least marginal.
Well, that's always puzzled me from the beginning, why this government in Kiev, even though it's a temporary government, does have a disproportionate number of these right-wing ultra-nationalists in their government. But I guess the paradox of all this, surely, John Quigley, is that Putin's actions have, in fact, stimulated nationalism and a nationalistic backlash, both in Ukraine and in the Baltics. So, this is a direct consequence, I think, of this notion of the big power to the east intimidating these former Soviet republics.
Well, the main thing that Russia has done so far is to accept Crimea into its territory. And that, I think, is something on which it's rather difficult to fault Mr. Putin. This is something that was widely called for by the population of Crimea. There's a long history there of its affiliation with Russia. So I think that there's been a bit too much read into that.
Well, clearly, as you pointed out earlier, the U.S. has accepted it and the West has accepted it. But that's not to say that agreements reached on territorial integrity and respecting territorial integrity, as was reached in the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, is that to say they're worthless? That the Ukrainians aren't too happy about losing this territory.
That's true. They're not happy about it at all. And they did have that Budapest memorandum that you're referring to. The United States, I should point out, does not consider that to be a firm obligation. It does not consider
right.
it a treaty.
Sure.
So it's backed off it somewhat.
Right. And if Ukraine were a member of NATO, I don't think there's much the U.S. would have done. They're not going to go to war over Crimea. But in terms of international law, which is your background after all, John Quigley, this is not how nations are supposed to behave, is it? Just abrogate agreements, whether they're memoranda or treaties?
Well, you know, when a statement is put out, I mean, like this joint statement today in Geneva, it's not considered something that binds in the way a treaty does, although... Yeah, you know, you can certainly say it's bad faith when you sign on to something that looks like it's an agreement and then you don't carry through with it.
Which then leads us to be cautious about this agreement, surely.
Oh yes, for sure. And this isn't really an agreement. It's a statement of what the parties hope will happen in Ukraine.
Right. Well, let's hope it's more than that. And I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Quigley.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Quigley. He's a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses of War, American Interventionism Since World War II. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into whether or not Ukraine will go nuclear again.